Hi, today's August 22nd, 2021. I'm Todd Agassor with your friend John Westfall, and this is MobileViews Podcast 372. I think we've been off the air 3 weeks.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, just a little, lot of stuff going on. Yep, it's been busy. And we still need to get some old friends on, like Andy, on the podcast. Andy, if you're listening, we'll get you on soon. Trying to get through some technical and scheduling challenges, and mostly on my part, because you know John is never challenged, like on top of it. But anyway, before
I wish that were true. I've had strange challenges as of late.
But before we begin, I wanted to congratulate an old friend who's been on this podcast a few times, Ryan Ozawa. He is one of the 25 independent local journalists across the U.S. that was selected by the Facebook journalism initiative called Facebook Bulletin. And so I think he's going to be getting some monetary support and some platform support and, you know, be able to continue the amazing, amazing work he's been doing for decades now. I mean, I've known him for maybe 20 years, and he's been doing this a lot longer than that, of really just telling a local story. A lot of it is about local technology in a local setting here in Hawaii, but also lots of other stuff. And so look for that name, Ryan Ozawa, O-Z-A-W-A. I'm sure you'll be reading a lot more of his stuff in the near future, and it's going to be on something called Facebook Bulletin. So I'm, or sponsored by Facebook Bulletin. I think the branding is actually your own. It's not a, you know, it'll be, might see something else. I got to go read more about it. But at any rate, I'll put a link in the show notes for folks who are interested in that. So we know somebody famous, John.
Yeah, that's very good. I'm happy about that.
Yeah. Okay, next thing. So, John, as you might recall, I've been a loyal Google Pixel phone user for a long time, since the Pixel, maybe before they called it a Pixel. I forget what they called the original one. But my first Pixel was a Pixel 2. And then I got a 3A, and then I got a 4A last year, and now a 5A is soon to come out. You can pre-order it now. And, you know, generally I don't buy a phone every year, except the 4A was such a giant leap over to 3A. And also I was running out of space in my 3A, which only had 64 gigs of storage. That I did do, for the first time I bought a new Android phone with only 1 year in between the old and the new one. So am I going to do it again? So the 5A is a little bit cheaper than a 4A, which was kind of expensive, I thought, for a Pixel. It was almost $500, $499. The 5A is going to be $449, $450. So you know, it's a little bit more affordable. And I guess if I really scrounged around in my wallet, I could come up with the coins to pay for a new one. But I don't know. Let's go through a couple of things. Well, it's IP67 rated for water resistance. It's more water resistant and dust resistant than the 4A. That's a good thing. It's got a much bigger battery. It's 4,620 milliamps versus 3,140 for the one I got. Still has a 3.5-inch headphone jack, unlike the iPhone, which is kind of handy. And something lacks, though. If I read the specs correctly, it is not eligible for unlimited storage in Google Photos, which older Pixel phones are. So, for example, I switched from using mostly my iPhone for photos to using mostly my Pixel 4a for photos, because you know, for everyday photos, because photos I take on the 4a stored in Google Photos are still unlimited, free and unlimited, unlike, you know, starting it from anything else. So it was kind of a good situation. But apparently if you get a 5a, that's not one of the things listed in the specs, and it is listed for the 4A, so I thought that was kind of interesting. Other than that, the camera looks pretty good. I think it's got ultra-wide, which mine doesn't. I think the 4A 5G has ultra-wide, but mine doesn't. But I've got ultra-wide on an iPhone, so, you know. I mean, how often do I use it? I use it maybe a couple times a week. I'm willing to burn that storage, that non-free storage, by taking the photo on an iPhone. Is it worth $450 to buy a 5A if I already have a 4A? I'm going to say no. I'm probably not going to upgrade unless there's some kind of a new feature that I don't see in the tech spec sheets, which has been released by Google. But It's a good, you know, it looks like a good phone if you don't already, if you have an older Android phone and you don't mind losing the unlimited Google Photo storage. Maybe that was just a misprint. They didn't type in that spec, but I thought that was kind of a curious thing to be missing.
I mean, I do know that the 5A's camera is a little bit, it's on par with, you know, the 5's camera. And so maybe bigger pictures, bigger, you know, more space used. But yeah, I've been hearing good things about the 5A. And so it's one of those things where if you want a Pixel, but you don't want to pay a lot and you're okay with, you know, not waiting for the 6, the 5A seems like a decent device, especially if you're new to the Android ecosystem. Maybe you want to try it over iPhone. Might not be a bad one to play with.
Yeah, and even though it's $450 sounds like a lot of money, and it is, it's still half the price of a typical premium iPhone or Android phone. So it's affordable in that sense. And I have to say, I've been very happy with my 4A. The only thing I would fault and it's a fault of myself, not the phone, is that I really haven't used this astrophotography feature enough. And so it's one of those things I kind of would like to do over the next couple of months as it gets darker earlier, and maybe I'll remember to use it and fuss with it. But yeah, I don't think I'm getting a 5A. Might wait for a 6A next year. I don't think I'm going to get a 6 because it's just too expensive, and I don't really think I need all the features or whatever. Okay, another thing I almost bought and then I decided I didn't need yet is, you know, so I gave my daughter my relatively new late 2019 model HP Windows 10 laptop a couple of weeks ago, because when she restarted grad school, we found out that for whatever reason, the Java app, and I know this sounds weird, the Java app just would not run on a Mac. And and I, you know, she brought it over to, you know, to our home to for me to take a look at, and you know, I took a look at it and I fussed with it, and I couldn't get it to work either. And she talked to her school's tech support and they said, yeah, it doesn't really work on a Mac, which, you know, so that write once, run anywhere, that's just full of caca. Anyway, so I don't have a recent vintage Windows laptop anymore. I have desktops and stuff. It's not that I don't have Windows. But I thought, well, maybe I should pick up a relatively inexpensive, you know, say $500 i3 Windows 10 laptop. And I thought, you know, maybe I should just wait for Windows 11. I wasn't going to run Windows 11, but since I'm probably going to buy a laptop anyway, you know, why don't I just wait for that and see if there's some inexpensive Windows 11 laptop when it comes out. I don't know. Do you know when it's coming out? Later this, end of this year, maybe?
And we might even then, you want to, you know, once it's out, it might even be best to wait another few months to let things, I guess, settle out to figure out what the best device would be.
Right. And for folks who are wondering, for our fives of listeners who may be wondering, well, why do you even need a Windows laptop? Or since you said you already have some Windows desktops and stuff, why don't you just upgrade those to fuss with Windows 11? I'd say, well, that's a reasonable question, except so far nothing I own, and they're not that old. You know, nothing's, that stuff I've tried with, nothing old is older than maybe 3-4 years old. So it's not super old. Mm-hmm. None of them are able to be upgraded to Windows 11 from what I can tell. Using the tool, which apparently was flawed, and in the Windows, I used the Windows Insider site, has a checker too, and so I thought, oh, I'll try Windows 11 Insider, you know, and I said, no, you can't run Windows 11 Insider on this, on anything I own. And then so I said, well, okay, since it won't run on anything relatively recent, you know, and the notebook I gave my daughter is 2 years old, well, less than 2 years old actually. I said, well, if it won't run on that, and that's a pretty nicely configured laptop, I said, well, what's the odds it'll run on, you know, i3 or whatever? So I said, I'll just skip it. It's not like I really need a Windows device in my life at the moment. So I'll just wait till the Windows 11 devices come out and not take a chance of spending $500 on something that can't be upgraded. I think Windows 11 is going to be a huge public relations nightmare for Microsoft. They just blew it.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of Windows 11 at this point. It's something that, you know, Microsoft basically is directly contradicting themselves. They said they weren't going to have major versions of Windows anymore, and then we go from 10 to 11, and then break a bunch of compatibility when you go from 10 to 11, apparently, because that's what the tool tells us. But at the same time, I don't know how something that's iterative can break in one fell swoop so much compatibility. So I think we're still waiting to figure out if Windows 11 is really a big deal or if it is simply the next, you know, what we would think of as a Windows 10 update, like the Creator update and the other updates that we've had in the past. So I don't know what quite to make of it, and I would be very hesitant to buy something right when it comes out, even at that point. I think I need to give it some more time to see what exactly Windows 11 is and isn't before I just make decisions on it.
Especially for something that we really, well, I won't speak for you, but I don't need. It's interesting to have. It's not even a nice to have. It's just kind of curiously interesting to have kind of thing. So I'm perfectly happy with my MacBook Air M1, which is still awesome. Mm-hmm. And even this MacBook Pro 2019 that I have, that's, you know, aging very nicely. No complaints as it reaches almost 2 years old later this year. Okay, so I guess in a couple of months we'll wait and see. I did get a demo of Windows 365, by the way, the cloud PC thing. So that was kind of interesting. It'll be interesting to see how well it is received by the enterprise crowd, because right now I need a business type license. I guess small business would work too. Anyway, speaking of new stuff, John, you've been looking at something that surprised me.
Yeah, so I've been paying attention to alternative form factors, in a sense, because, you know, we've had the same slab type phones for a while now, and foldables have been recently coming back into vogue over the last couple of years with the Motorola Razr reboot, or Motorola Flip reboot, or whatever they're, I forget the exact name of it, but we all know it's basically a Razr with touchscreens. And, of course, Microsoft's Surface Duo. So, of course, Samsung has been in on this market, and they have had the Flip 3, the Z Flip 3, and the Z Fold 3 that are coming out this month. You can pre-order them now. And they even have, and I just found this, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes, they even have what you might think of as premium versions. They have a Tom Brown edition Galaxy Z Fold 3 that, you know, for $26.49.99, you get a number of interesting things in the box. You get the phone, and then I believe you get other things along with it.
You should get a gold bullion with that price.
I mean, it is pretty amazing. In the box, you get the wireless charger, you get the travel adapter, you get the actual pen for it. You get another charger, you get a leather cover, you get the Galaxy Buds 2, you get the Galaxy Watch 4. I mean, this is like your 100% solution here for whatever you know, your mobile life. It's almost like if you didn't have any smart devices, Samsung has you covered for $26.49.
That's a lot of dollars.
So, yeah, obviously, Samsung is really hedging their bets that you're going to like their new foldables.
I guess so.
And I've been watching a few reviews on YouTube and reading some reviews, and it almost looks like these devices are ready for prime time. The fold between the crease where the fold is and the touchscreen is getting less and less noticeable. They're getting a better idea of how to make these screens. And, of course, they're getting to a point where maybe at some point Apple will swoop in and make a foldable. I'm sure that's on their radar here and there. But yeah. I guess I'm curious to get your thoughts on if these form factors are something you're interested in, and if so, what do you see maybe for the next 5 years if they were to fit into what you want to do mobile-wise?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, John, because, as you know, I carry an iPad mini and a phone, actually two phones, because I want a bigger screen, and having a foldable screen, you know, we'd probably get pretty close to iPad mini size in total screen area. So it would allow me perhaps to, you know, reduce to one device to carry, you know, one phone to rule them all versus feeling the need to carry both an iPad and an iPhone and in my case also a Pixel phone. I'm really interested if it could do that. You know, we've had folding flip phones before, but generally speaking, they only had one screen, or they had one regular screen and then a tiny, tiny, tiny LCD screen on the back for notifications and time of day and that sort of thing. You probably remember that one, John. I think one of our Motorola Windows mobile phones we had way back in the day did that. Boy, that's going to be interesting. You know, the problem is that, well, the problem for me is Android, and so far only Android devices, only Android devices have had, no iPhones, of course, have had. Android is a terrible tablet environment. I mean, just terrible. Mm-hmm. I was at Costco the other day, and I saw a reasonably nicely configured Samsung, I think it was a 10-inch, I think it was a 10-inch Android tablet. It was like $180, nice amount of memory, nice amount of storage, and all, pretty decent-looking screen, but in the end, it's running Android. And while Android is great on a phone, it is terrible on a tablet, and I know because I've tried it several times. I've bought three, and if you count, the only one that's pretty decent is the Kindle Fire.
Yeah.
But, Amazon has really modified the point where, you barely know it's an Android device, and it doesn't have any of the Google stuff. So, it doesn't feel like an Android device. I'm curious. I don't know, John. I'm not going to go. And they're expensive, so I'm not going to go rush out and buy one.
I have the same sort of thought with it, and I like both of the designs. And so I really, this is going to sound horrible, I probably would not end up going down to one device. So imagine a scenario where I don't want to get rid of a smartwatch, so I'd get a Galaxy Watch if I wanted to be in that ecosystem, or any other Android Wear watch that was decent, and I like the idea of the flip where I've got the small device in my pocket that is kind of the size of a square, that flips up to a full size phone. But I really like the idea of the fold as well, because then I wouldn't need a tablet. I just have a phone and a tablet. So until you can do something where I can flip, where I can fold it two times, fold it over and then fold it over again, which in theory is possible.
It's possible.
I don't think I'd go for it yet. And plus, I'd need to do an ecosystem change. I'd have to go from Mac to from Mac, iPad, iPhone, all the way to Android again, which isn't something I'd rule out. But I don't think I want to be carrying more devices than I need to, just because I already have four devices that I carry with me daily when you consider laptop, iPad, iPhone, Apple Watch. So, but I do find them interesting. And if I had one, would I carry it with me and play with it all day? It's possible. It's possible.
Same.
Because they are cool.
They are cool looking. They're expensive. They are an ecosystem shift for at least you. For me, it'd be kind of half a shift since I do use a Pixel. Mm-hmm. But it would still be a considerable change. I mean, I am so productive on my iPad mini. Use it every day practically. And every workday for sure. Tough one. Interesting. And I'm still waiting for, on the Windows side of the world, I'm still waiting for the Microsoft Neo, if you remember that, the folding tablet/notebook design running Windows 10. That was supposed to come out, that was rumored around the time the Duo first got leaked. And I'm still waiting to see if, I think it's Asus, not Acer. I think it's Asus. Asus ZenBook Duo. There's supposed to be a $1,000 version that I still don't see. I only see the $2,000 version. So I'm really curious about that. I think that would be a very interesting, alternative to having a physical external monitor on your notebook. Having a bigger monitor is still better. But having that little-ish, I guess it's like 5-inch diagonal display right above the keyboard, I still think that's interesting. Keep a notepad there and a browser and a big screen or vice versa, something. I think there's a good use case there, but can't find an affordable one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is that's my looking at random other devices other than a flat phone. But I do have an interesting hack solution to talk about this week for people so this is me making things work in random ways that other people might not have this issue. But so like many people, my home network, I have some virtual machines running on it. I have my own devices that that stay home, that don't go with me places, that I can connect to remotely. And I have a VPN. That is how I get into my home network, so that I securely get in from a remote network without having to expose different ports and other random stuff that isn't good security-wise. But I've had a weird problem, and that is occasionally I am on a computer that is not my own, and I really wish I could connect to my own devices easily from it. And by that, I mean I can't easily download OpenVPN and set it up and put in my client certificate and all those things to make a VPN connection to my home, and then have to have VNC or SSH or something to connect to the home network. So I have come up with a solution using two open source products. One is Apache Guacamole, which is an HTML5 compliant VNC and SSH client. So basically you can run this completely in the browser. It supports authentication. It supports multi-factor authentication. So you can connect up to anything on your home network or anything that it can connect to. It can also be on a remote network if it's exposed to the internet. And you couple that with a Docker image that's called it. What that allows you to publish out your Apache Guacamole installation over port 443. So what this basically allows me to do is from any computer on the internet, connect to a domain name that I own and a subdomain of it, that I can then authenticate using HTTP basic authentication. It asks for my two-factor authentication code, so I've got an extra layer of code there in case someone were to get my password. And then I can connect to any of my local devices or even devices that are on my VPN. So in practice, what this means is I can be at my work, on my work network. I have my laptop in one office across campus that's connected to my home VPN. I can then be on a public computer, say in a classroom, log in and connect to my device that's on the local network by going through my home network. It's a little slower, but it is usable. It's not too laggy, and it's secured at all ends, and really opens up some doors to if I go somewhere for a meeting and I think, well, I don't need my iPad, I don't need anything other than my phone, and then I'm waiting 20 minutes for the meeting to start, and I think, ooh, if I was only at my computer right now, I could do a couple of quick tasks. I can get in from any public computer that I can have access to, and thankfully on our campus, every classroom tends to have a computer that would be there for the instructor, and I can log into any of those. So hop in that, connect up, punch in my two-factor code, and I'm good to go.
That's amazing. I've never heard about Apache's Guacamole project.
It is. Apache Foundation has all these random projects that nobody's ever heard of. Which is sort of unfortunate. But Guacamole is an interesting one. It supports VNC, RDP, and SSH. And so it makes for a very useful product.
I'm looking at the website, but so for the two-factor authentication, what kind of second factor does it support in addition to passwords?
It supports basically Google Authenticator, TOTP. So you can plug that into one password or any client that supports it, Microsoft Authenticator, etc.
Looks great. Clientless remote desktop gateway. I like it. It's amazing, actually. Yep. I mean, the more I think about it, the more amazing it is. Very cool.
Really one of those, like I said, it's really sad that Apache has all of these random products that nobody knows about. Or that are part of the Apache Foundation.
You know, it's funny. 20 years ago, when I was deep, deep, deep into open source solutions, I guess I'm not now. But, I was really deep into it, giving talks on it and that sort of thing. I used to keep up with every single major Apache project because, you have to be promoted before you become an official project versus, just whatever their next tier down is, where it's being considered. And so, everybody knows about HTTP, Apache's web server and And then a few people know about some of the other stuff they did. And then all the Java, projects emerge. And I just lost track of Apache because, like you said, there are just too many now to try to keep track of.
And I just put a link in our show notes to the Wikipedia page, list of Apache Software Foundation projects. And it is a giant amount of things.
Huge, huge. Hey, I'm going to talk about one more thing before we call it a podcast. It is something called, and it's very confusing because it's called cursive. Oops, I messed up our notes here. Let me go over here. It's called, Google calls it their project Cursive, and it is a piece. Well, is it a software? I think it's a PWA, a progressive, you know, web app kind of thing, application. Mm-hmm. Typing and talking at the same time. But at any rate, no, wrong one. Anyway, it's a PWA called Cursive, and it's for Chromebooks, and it's another note-taking app. And you go like, well, Todd, don't you have enough note-taking apps? And apparently not. The answer is no. And you might ask, well, doesn't Google already have something? I mean, don't they have like Google Keep, which you like? I go, yeah, I do like Google Keep. But Google Cursive is interesting because it's, like I said, a PWA specifically for notebook Chromebooks with styluses. And most of my Chromebooks except for one, have a stylus. The weird thing is, especially since it's a progressive web app, is why is it only available on the HP Chromebook X211, which is not available yet? And that's what I can't, you know, why don't they just release it? And it should work on every Chromebook with a touchscreen and a stylus. And answer is, I don't know. But I am curious to see how it works and if it's any good. And, you know, if it only works on a Chromebook, then it's not going to be very useful. If I can't access the notes on my phone and so forth, which is what made Evernote so good in its heyday and makes Google Keep so good now, is I can, everywhere there's a web browser and app, I can get to it. So I'm looking forward to it. I might buy a Chromebook X211 because it's a detachable Chromebook. So the keyboard separates from the notebook like a Surface. And it's 11 inches. That's where the 11 comes from. Chromebook X211 is 11-inch display. So it's a nice, you know, tablet size screen. And the interface looks interesting. It looks kind of keepish in my opinion. But I'm really thinking about it. I'm really, really, really thinking hard about it. So, anyway, Google Cursive for Chrome OS. Kind of curious. We'll see where it goes. And maybe I'll buy another Chromebook. I'm thinking about doing a little blog item about longevity of my Chromebooks, by the way. Because the two low-end Chromebooks... Actually, I bought four Chromebooks over the last 4 or 5 years. Fortunately, they're inexpensive enough that that's not a hardship. Yeah, but 3 out of 4 Chromebooks become flaky. So, you know, I guess you get what you pay for, and you don't pay much for Chromebooks. So maybe that's what you should expect. But still disappointing, because these are name brands, you know. Bought two Lenovos. The first Lenovo I bought, the C330 or C320 maybe. The keyboard is going bad. Same for the very first notebook I bought, which was a Samsung. Talking about Samsung. Samsung Chromebook Plus. I think its keyboard is going bad. It's 3 years old, 4 years old, something like that. And the Acer I bought, which I had high hopes for, the Acer Spin 13, I think, which is a real nice device, but it's just flaky. Sometimes it just reboots all by itself, even, you know, after several firmware upgrades. So I think I'm going to do it. Oh, Siri wants to talk to me for some reason. No, Siri, I don't want to talk to you. little article I might do after I think about what it is I'm really looking at. All right, John. Well, it's nice talking to you after a 3-week hiatus. And I'll check with your schedule, see where you are next couple of weeks, and we'll get together again at some point. I think there's supposed to be a September iPhone event.
Yep, and there's rumors there might even be 2 events in September.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we'll have some fun playing around with that when we see it.
Yep. Okie dokie. Well, that brings a relatively short podcast, but once again, we managed to fill up 30 minutes of time. So we will talk to you next time. Thanks, John.
Mm-hmm.